Thanks a lot for this invitation. It's very good to be here. It's the first time. And I want to present you work I've done in collaboration with Marie-Carmen Banölz and Ignacio Sirac from the MPQ in Munich. And in my world, Stefan is still in Munich, but you got him. You should be very lucky. And then there's Christoph in Poznan and Hanna. She left, unfortunately, for industry. This is a car provider company in Japan. And what I want to do today is I want to give you a flavor where we stand in lattice QCD calculations and that we made really a large progress in that field, but that there are open questions that that cannot be solved with our methods. And for this, we need the Hamiltonian approach. And the practical method there is tensor networks, in particular matrix product states. So to bring us to the same level somehow, let me remind you how we know that there are quarks. Quarks are bound in hadrons, so we are not able to observe them. So how do we know that they exist? And this was a very famous experiment by Friedman and Kendall in 1972. They shot electrons to the proton, and they saw that the cross-section is essentially independent from the energy you probe the proton. And the interpretation by Feynman and Bjorkane was that actually that there are three valence quarks or partons, they called it at that time. And so if you have some particle going through, they don't notice them. And if you do the right normalization of this, you indeed find that this is a three. And this was the very first time in history that people started to believe that the proton is composed out of three partons. Nowadays, this has, of course, very much evolved. So if you have the cross-section here with the structure functions F, then this starts with the three for the three partons. But then the picture is, of course, much more complicated. You have a spontaneous generation of quark-anti-quark pairs. You have gluons there. And out of a delta function, you have a complicated function, which you can describe to some extent in perturbation theory. And this deviation from three, it's called Bjorkane scaling violation, you can actually use by data that you can measure very precisely and fit to such forms. For example, at DAISY, where I'm coming from, you can extract the value of the strong coupling constant and the complete momentum dependence of these coupling constants. So this is very nice, and this is very good confirmed, and we know that there are quarks. Now, why do we need then lattice QCD, a non-perturbative method? And the reason is very simple. So first of all, the situation in the proton is very, very complicated. Even this is a Mickey Mouse picture of the inner life of a proton. So you have billions of generations of quark and anti-quarks, complicated interactions between the gluons. And it's clear, in order to describe this situation, it's extremely difficult. But it's not only a question that you order your calculation and you try to get all these diagrams into account, but there's a conceptual problem. The conceptual problem is that we saw this already. The strong coupling constant depends on the energy and correspondingly on the distance. And if you go to a distance that is typical for the diameter of the proton, this value of the coupling becomes order one. So there is, in principle, there is no way for perturbation theory to describe a proton, and you need a different and hopefully exact method to do this. And this is more than all Feynman diagrams. Here are really non-perturbative effects, and this led Wilson to invent what we now call lattice QCD. And this really, this had to be invented because QCD has a Janus head, and we demand from QCD, our theory of the strong interaction, that it describes two sides. One side where the distances are much, much smaller than one. And then you enter the worlds of the quarks and the gluons, and you have indeed a perturbative description. At the same time, we demand from QCD that it describes also the right-hand side, where you go to distances that are larger than one Fermi, and then you enter the world of hadrons and blue balls. So these are really the particles that we can observe. And here you enter the world of confinement, here of asymptotic freedom, and here you clearly need non-perturbative methods. And I'm still quoting Wilson from 1976, who said at that time, unfortunately, it is not known yet whether the quarks in QCD actually form these required bound states, the world of the hadrons. And to establish whether these bound states exist, one must solve a strong coupling problem. And present methods for solving field theories don't work for strong coupling. And this was his motivation to go to lattice QCD and try to find a non-perturbative method to solve all these questions. By the way, if you have questions, then you can, of course, ask me immediately. You don't have to wait 40 years for this, okay? Okay, so what is lattice QCD? Let me give you an example that I actually do in an 8-week summer student programs with students at the bachelor level. So they understand this. Okay, they have 8 weeks, you only have 10 minutes now, but I think it's possible. So we start with the Schwinger model. This is a model Schwinger invented in 1962 to test certain things. And we go to Feynman's path integral, so we integrate over all possible field configurations of the gauge fields and the matter fields, the fermions, and we weight this, I'm already Euclidean here, with the gauge action and the fermion action. So the fermion action is given by this covariant derivative between the antiparticles and the particles, and this is the gauge covariant derivative containing the gauge potential. And the gauge part itself is simply the field strength tensor that is given here. And this, you know, if you would do this classically, you would obtain Maxwell's equations in two dimensions. Through this quantization in Feynman's path integral, you really have a fully quantized system of the Schwinger model. This is in the continuum. This model is interesting by itself because it shows the confinement of charges. It has bound states. It exhibits the phenomenon of chiral symmetry breaking. It's super renormalizable, which makes it very nice for calculations because you don't have to care about many things. And it's a very good test case for massless quarks because then it is exactly solvable. So this is actually a typical or very welcome benchmark model for us to test ideas, algorithms, and things like this. Okay, so let's put this theory, this nice theory on the lattice. So what do? We have a two-dimensional lattice. We have a lattice spacing A, because that is the distance between two points. And then we put our fermion fields on these lattice sides, which become then integers. And then we define the action in this way here. So this is the derivative term. And what we do is actually something, this is the most naive thing you can think of. We take this forward and backward derivatives. And this is nothing but nearest neighbor differences of the fermion fields divided by the lattice spacing, such that in the limit that A goes to zero, you recover the continuum derivative. There is a second order derivative term, which is just there to avoid some unwanted modes that you would get if you don't have this term. I will not discuss this here. It's just a technical thing that complicates our life, but we can control this very well. So far, these are essentially free fermions. We don't have gauge fields. So how do we introduce gauge fields? And I think this is the point where Wilson really had some ingenious idea. Namely, he said, it's not the gauge potentials that are the fundamental objects that we should look at, but it's really this parallel transporter, this so-called link variable that starts from a point X and then goes in some direction mu. So if the fields, the matter fields live on a point on the lattice, these link variables just connect these lattice points. And when you use this object here, then you can define a gauge covariant derivative in this form here. You multiply the nearest neighbor with these gauge links that points from X to mu and reaches then the field at the neighboring point. And you can show if you take the limit A going to zero from this expression and from this derivative here, you find the continuum gauge covariant derivative. What about the field strength tensor? You want to keep gauge invariance. So what you do is you have closed loops. So you go around such a so-called plaquette. So you have a product of these gauge transporters that go around this plaquette here. You need four of them to close the loop on such a quadratic lattice. And again, you can show if you take the continuum limit, you recover the continuum field strength tensor. So now we have all elements on the lattice. We have the gauge part. We take the real part of this so-called plaquette variable. We multiply it by a number beta, which is 1 over the coupling square. And we have the metafields with the quark mass m, this gauge covariant derivative, and the second order term to avoid the Dopplers. And then we quantize the system, again, by integrating over all fields and weight in this Euclidean theory by a Boltzmann factor e to the minus s. You have questions to that part? No? So then the task would be to implement this now and do a simulation.
This is Euclidean, right?
This is Euclidean, yes.
And then will you have to translate the results, or the results in Euclidean formalism are already, what do you want?
There are very strong theorems, this so-called reconstruction theorem, or let's phrase it differently, is if you can prove that this action is positive, reflection positive, then you can translate all Euclidean endpoint Green functions back to Minkowski space. So, for example, if you want to have a mass, you can immediately read off the mass or the K constant or things like this. You are guaranteed that you have the Minkowski analog. This was at the very early stages of lattice gate theories that people like Schrader or so, they proved these theorems. Yes. Of course, you do not only want to define the theory, but you want to compute something. For example, you want to compute the proton mass. So what you do is you integrate over all possible field configurations. You have the quantity you want to compute, the proton mass, weighed by the Boltzmann factor, and normalize everything by the partition function. Then you discretize this theory here in the way I just told you in the Schwinger model. Then you write the program, and then you put it on the supercomputer. And now Stefan is not allowed to answer this question. Does anybody know what supercomputer this is? No. Really? Only in one talk I got a positive answer on. This is really amazing. This is a Leibniz computer from 1670. So you could turn this wheel here, and this machine could do additions and multiplications at the time. It was the first machine ever that could do multiplications. This was 1670, so computers already existed at that time. And there are museums where you can find these machines and you can try it out. Now, of course, we don't want to calculate everything in the Schwinger model. We want to go to QCD. So what does this mean? The system becomes four-dimensional. So if you have a Schwinger model on a 50 by 50 lattice, you go to a 50 by 50 times 2,500 lattice, four dimensions. The gauge fields are not anymore from U1, but they are from SU3. The quarks receive four Dirac and three color components. And if you add this up, then you go from this situation of a 50 by 50 to 50 times 50 times 30,000. And if you now think that a typical simulation for the Schwinger model would be at the order of one day running your computer, now you have to take into account this factor of 30,000. And this means that you need massive parallelization to solve the problem. Also, conceptually, you really have to perform a large step. Namely, now you have to do a non-perturbative renormalization of the theory, which is really a project by itself. So people are only working on this to provide us for the necessary factors. Now, this sounds all very well, but here's a plot that really wrote history. In 2001, we organized a lattice conference in Berlin, and we asked collaborations worldwide to tell us what is the cost of their simulation. And here is one example by Ukawa from Japan. So what is plotted here is the teraflops years you need to compute a certain quantity, only one. So your laptop has maybe one gigaflop. So we are talking about 1,000 of your laptops working for 1 year to solve a problem. On this axis here, we have the ratio of the pi r mass to the rho mass. And this ratio in physics, in nature, is about here. And now if you go to a certain cutoff, let's say to an inverse lattice spacing of 3 GeV, you see that the costs explode exponentially. And if you extrapolate, it seems to be completely impossible to do the simulation. And this led Wilson to speculate already in 1989 that both a 10 to the 8 increase in computing power and spectacular algorithmic advances have to take place before a useful interaction these experiments can start.
So you're saying like the dot should be to the left-hand side?
Hmm?
For the calculation to be useful, you should push the cutoff to the other side?
Yes, exactly. So this is exactly what you will see now. And so this is the cost. And since the, if I understand your question correctly, I'm not sure.
Yeah, so you said that that was a problem, but why is that, what is the problem?
So you want to work at such a value of the lattice spacing? You do your calculation here, and you want to go here.
At the least, right?
You would like to the left, to the physical value of this ratio of the pion to the rho mass. So, and then you go, if you lower this ratio artificially, you go along this curve here. And therefore, your teraflop years you have to wait is astronomical. And since this was shown in Berlin in 2001, this was termed the Berlin Wall plot, because this really made it impossible. And of course, this plot was forbidden to show in public because we would not have gotten any cent for our calculations. At that point, only these more senior people start to laugh because they know what it means. Okay. And then for some reason in around 2006, 2005, 2006, there were a number of groups who found really large improvements on the situation. So this is the plot that I showed you before. And this is what we then had all of a sudden in 2006. So this is the same. This is the teraflop years as a function of the pion to the rho mass. You want to go here. And this seemed to be impossible there. But with these algorithmic tricks, you see that now you are along this curve here. And then you're at the order of a few teraflop years. And this is certainly possible with today's supercomputers. So this really changed completely the situation, because you still have a wall here, but on this axis here, you gained the factor of 100. So here is a 20, here is just a quarter of a teraflop here. And this was really a fantastic improvement. The story went on, and nowadays this is completely flat here, almost down to the physical value of the pion mass. I don't want to go more into this. And at the same time, also...
Can you say what are the important advances that allowed...
So one was even on preconditioning. We staggered the lattice in red and blue colors, and we were allowed to look only at the blue points and reconstruct the red points. And this increased this decreased the condition number by a factor of 8. And the condition number of the fermion matrix that we have to invert is one essential element in the whole calculation. And the other was is that we found a way to do the simulations on different time steps. So we have the gauge fields and we have the fermion fields. The fermion fields are very expensive. The gauge fields are easy. And we discovered that we can simulate the gauge fields and the fermion fields on different timescales. So we did the gauge fields much, much more often than the fermion fields. And if you take all these factors together, then you found this large improvement. I think this was the major thing, this multiple time step algorithms that were found. And nowadays there are multi-grid ideas which seem to be even better. They finally work for lattice gate series.
So basically it is a method of in what order you do things, as well as of course better computers.
Yes, in this even. So there's one ordering in this even of preconditioning, and the other order is to put different parts of the action on different timescales. And fortunately, you can put the most expensive part on the coarsest time step in your calculation.
So the calculation in the end is sampling, Monte Carlo sampling?
This is Markov chain Monte Carlo.
And is there a time problem? Or?
Yeah, of course. You saw that in Euclidean, In Euclidean, we have this partition function, and this is a positive measure, okay? And Markov chain Monte Carlo methods only work on positive integration methods. They have to draw a random number from a positive probability distribution. And if this becomes complex, I will show you later, then Markov chain Monte Carlo will not work anymore.
But you still managed to get, the results you were showing were with sign problem or without
sign problem? Without sign. So far we have, so far we don't have a sign problem. Yeah. Fortunately. Okay.
T
Yeah, at the same time, of course, there was also some development since the Leibniz computer. So, for example, in Germany, we now have supercomputers. This is in Jülich, 5 petaflops, which now at this point in time goes to a 12 petaflop machine. In Berlin, we have 2 machines delivering 3 petaflops. In Munich, we have another system that delivers 3 petaflops. And we get access to these machines through some computer time proposals that we have to hand in. They are peer reviewed. And if you have a good proposal, you get supercomputer time on these machines. And please.
Can you parallelize it definitely? Or are you able, can you parallelize this algorithm indefinitely? Like
yeah.
Just goes on forever?
Yeah. If you lattice is large enough, this answers your question here. This is exactly what we do. So we parallelize the problem, and we put it on a number of processes, and we measure the performance of the algorithm.
Well, you already got to 1,000 there. That's not bad.
Right. This is hard to read. This is number of processors in units of 1,000. So what yeah, this was hard to read, but I wanted to say it. So at this point here, I think we had something like 250,000 processors working together on a single problem, on a single simulation. So we have a perfect scaling of the algorithm on the supercomputers.
That's like CPUs or like cores of some kind of parallel thing?
This has a very strong development. So in the early state, there were really, you had 250,000 cores. Then you, nowadays you have multi-core processors, like 32 cores on a processor. They're all connected to a very, very fast network. And this new machine that I told you, these 12 petaflops, this is a mixed of multi-core nodes and GPUs and other special architectures. So this is actually, it's very complicated to program. I'm really happy that there are still young people who are willing to do this work. It's, in some way, it's fantastic to do this, to know what the machine is doing. On the other side, it's very, very complicated. But we try to get access to any parallel computer we can, and we need it, and we do it. Okay, this I don't show. So, and this is, if you didn't understand what I said so far, this is what I wanted to convey. It, we went from this steam lock to a modern German ICE, a fast train that can run with 300 kilometers per hour. Now needs, I think, less than 4 hours from Berlin to Munich, if there is no ice or storm. Okay, and this really leads us that we now can compute the complete Hadron spectrum from lattice QCD. So what we do is we have 2 inputs. We need to fix the up, down, and strange quark. So we need we fix the up and down quarks from the pion, the strange quark from the kaon. And all the rest here is a prediction from lattice QCD from our calculation. And there are much more states. For example, here we went to more states with strange quarks and even charm quarks. And all the particles that we computed here, they came out to be all right. So this was really the first proof that lattice QCD can reproduce this Hadron spectrum and many more quantities. And I used to say, before these plots here, and I gave such talks, there was always one person in the audience asking me, before you can't show me that you reproduce the Hadron spectrum, I don't believe you a word. Now he has to believe me. But this is really, this was a major achievement and really,
What is the error?
Now you see the error here, right? So these are the errors. So they are for the nucleon, it's not very large. For the row, we even can include the resonance parameters. I will show you. And the lambda, so this is all included here. And I show you the precision we can reach.
So the definition of the nucleon, would this be 3 quarks or more complicated, also C or something like that?
So we have 3 valence quarks. Mm-hmm. So we define an operator that project on the proton state with the right quantum numbers. And the operator is composed out of 3 quarks, mm-hmm. up, down. And then we build the correlation function. And all the other quarks that are in the proton, they are taken into account automatically through the simulation. So we take into account all possible Z-quark effects, and we can actually compute the quark content of the nucleon. So we can compute nowadays what is the content of the up and the down quarks, what is the strange quark contribution, what is the charm quark contribution. This is all in our hands nowadays. Yeah. And just to show you the precision we can do today is, you know that the up and the down quarks have different masses. They are also charged. And both effects lead to the fact that the neutron is heavier than the proton, which is very fortunate for us, because else we would not exist. And this group here tried to reproduce not only the proton mass, but even the difference between the neutron and the proton mass. And they calculated the effect, yeah, now comes again the question, from QED, which I believe is this one. I'm colorblind, so I'm always messing this up. And the effect from the isospin splitting, which is the difference of the quark mass in the proton. And if they add this up, they get this bar here, and this is consistent with the experimental measurement of the difference of the proton and the neutron mass. And this is a totally amazing calculation, because this difference is at the order of 1 MeV. The proton mass is at the order of 1 GeV. So we are talking here about a precision at the per mil level. Okay? But this is possible nowadays through these algorithmic and machine advances that we have. And just to finish this part, what we can also do nowadays, we can compute resonances. These are deep Minkowski quantities. And we can map out, through certain techniques, we can map out the phase shift as a function of the center of mass energy. And this was our pioneering calculation where we did this the first time in QCD. And of course, the error were large, but it was there. And here this group now in 2013 had a very precise calculation of the phase shift. And through this technique, we can really not only compute masses of hadrons, but we can also compute the resonance structure and the resonance parameters. And I think this is also a very nice thing. So we are supermen. We can do everything in lattice QCD. Everything else is not needed anymore. Yeah. However, there are dangerous animals on the lattice. And the dangerous animal, this we discussed already, what we compute as an observable in Euclidean field space has this form here, and this needs a real and positive probability density measure, this one here. Else Markov chain Monte Carlo cannot work, because you have to draw random numbers from such a probability distribution. This is the basis of it. Now, if this action here would become complex, then this way of computing observables is inaccessible to standard Markov chain Monte Carlo. Now, for proton masses, resonances, and all this, this is not the case. We can really take the standard QCD action. However, if you would, say, add a chemical potential, or we would add a theta term, a topological term, which is relevant for CP violation, then the action becomes complex, and Markov chain Monte Carlo does not work. What it would do, it would see such a highly oscillating integrant, and now if you integrate over such field configurations, what you would observe is that the error of an observable as a function of the sample size is not only large, it spans really an order of magnitude, but it's also constant. So it's not like in standard Markov chain Monte Carlo, the more you sample, the more the error goes down. But as a function of the sample size, the error is essentially constant. And this is bad, of course. This is bad because it prevents us to really understand most of the phase diagram in QCD. So what we can do very well is to go to a zero chemical potential and investigate this line here, also the temperature dependence. But what we cannot do, we cannot go inside this phase diagram. So we do not understand really how the early universe developed, because there you need the chemical potential. We cannot really make predictions for experiments of heavy ions, like at RIC or at FAIR in Germany, And we cannot say anything about exotic phases like this color superconductivity that is speculated that it would exist. And what we can also not do, we cannot really say how the process of such phase transitions would happen. We cannot do real-time simulations, because also for this you would need Minkowski space, and we are strictly in Euclidean space. So these are things that are so far rather inaccessible to us. And it's not only this, it's also CP violation. There's evidence, or we measure CP violation, which induces, of course, the difference between particle and antiparticles. And this means that we can have an asymmetry between matter and antimatter. And this, in the end, allows that there are more baryons than antibaryons. And this, again, leads to the fact that we exist. And we want to know how this happened. What is the effect? And we cannot do this with Markov chain Monte Carlo. And you can get CP violation from the electroweak and the strong sector of the standard model. If you only look at the electroweak sector, then you find that the amount of CP violation could lead to an antimatter, a matter-antimatter symmetry of about 10 to the minus 11. No, sorry, got it wrong. The observed antimatter, matter-antimatter symmetry of the universe is about 10 to the minus 11. From the electroweak interaction, you might get something at the order of 10 to the minus 24. So you have a small factor discrepancy here, and you want to understand where this is coming from. And there is the possibility that some of this amount could come from QCD, which would amount that you add such a topological term. Again, this would mean that we have a complex action, and again, this would mean we are not able to do this. Now, I have a solution for you. The solution is to take not the action principle, but take the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is defined in Minkowski space, and it should be able to handle the sign problem, to handle complex systems. The practical problem here is, if you look at the ground state wave function in a certain basis, then this is described by a high-dimensional tensor. So this is a coefficient matrix with 2 to the n entries. And you are easily led to the Rice-Korn problem in chess, that if you go to a certain number of n, then even Berlin is covered completely by Rice, and you cannot do the calculation. So in the early stages of lattice gate theory, Wilson himself, he formulated everything in the Hamiltonian language. And then people tried to start Hamiltonian calculations for lattice gate theories. And because of this problem here, they very fast gave up, and they didn't find a solution. And at the same time, Michael Kreutz performed the first Markov chain Monte Carlo calculation, where he showed that you can treat four-dimensional systems, and you can have phase transition and all this. And this was really the start of the success story that I told you towards computing the Hadron spectrum. And then the Hamiltonian approach since that time was essentially completely forgotten in lattice gate theory. Nobody did this anymore. But fortunately, then I met Ignazio Sirac, and he explained me something. He explained me, if you have a system with a mass gap, delta, and you have knowledge about only a local density operator, whatever it is, but it is local, it only connects nearest neighbor sites, and you are able to approximate this local density with a certain accuracy delta, then you can get the ground state wave function with a precision L times delta divided by the mass gap. And this means that in principle, you can do a calculation that is not exponentially hard, but it scales polynomially in the system size L. There are proofs about this for gap systems. You can rephrase this in terms of the entropy. You can say there is a surface area law, that the entanglement between the subsystem and the rest only grows with the boundary of the subsystem. So this subsystem, three dimension, is an area. The states that fulfill this law here, that the entanglement entropy really only grows with the area, they form a very small corner of the Hilbert space, but these states are the physically relevant states. And of course, you see, if you have such an area law and you have a system with a mass gap, then the entropy only scales logarithmically. Or if you have a critical system, it only scales logarithmically with the system size. And this is, of course, an exponential improvement compared to states where the entropy scales with the system size itself. So this, in principle, means that if I can find this area law states here, then the size of my Hilbert space is exponentially smaller than what I thought it is. And this generalizes in larger dimensions that it goes with the area law. So these are very nice theoretical and general statements, but can we use this? And to my surprise, this can be used. This can be used in a very simple way, namely through an ansatz, which is a matrix product state, where you say that the wave function I'm looking for is simply given by a trace of a product of matrices with dimension d times d, where d is the bond dimension. So this is an ansatz, and this II here is the physical index, for example, plus minus 1/2 for an easing model. Okay, so this looks very innocent, and how on earth should this work? How on earth can this work? I think this I leave out. Do I leave this out? Sorry, here's something missing now. Okay, I know my logic now. So we tried this out in the, something is messed up here. I'm missing a slide, so I have to say it. Very good. I'm back on track. So the point is, if you want to have the ground state of your system with an accuracy epsilon zero, then the minimal bond dimension, the minimal size of the matrix that you want to use in this matrix product ansatz to reach this accuracy is larger than L to the alpha, which again means that the size of your matrix does not scale exponentially, which you might expect naively, but it scales polynomially only. So it becomes tractable. And there is a very strong theorem, this is Hastings' theorem, that if you have a gapped system, then you have an exponentially fast convergence to the exact ground state wave function in the bond dimension D. Exponentially fast. And this convinced me completely that this, first of all, that you get to the solution, and that you get to the solution in a very controlled and fast way. And this is why this matrix product state ansatz is so useful. You can go to Hastings' papers and read the proof for this.
Can I add?
Yeah.
I mean, you also have the caveat for ground state properties. When you explore the phase diagram, does the mass gap get, or does the temperature and the chemical potential, do they play the role of the mass gap, or?
No, this is, So we have this theorem is a mathematical theorem,
yeah,
which holds when the conditions are fulfilled. But what we see in practice is that we also have a very fast convergence, even if we go to non-zero temperature.
Okay.
Yeah. So even if you have really mixing of all possible phases, you get this convergence. And you can also go, like in the Schwinger model, you can go to the massless case. So you don't have a mass gap anymore, but still we see this convergence.
Do you understand that? Or do we understand this? Or do you have an intuition why it's converging so quickly if there's no mass
gap? I don't have. Stefan, do you have?
First of all, okay, if you look at the finite ladder, it's typically still a gap, and then you extrapolate all the thermodynamic limits. So for the finite ladders, you can do the calculation, and you just check the error with increasing bond dimension, and you really see it's nicely going down, and that everything is going in a controlled way. And then you can take the limit to the
Yeah, so maybe the lattice provides an infrared cutoff.
Yes.
but this is really hand waving, huh? Because at non-zero temperature, you really have mixture. So we are very happy to have this, this theorem, but we are much more happy that it also works for situations where.
So this theorem is in one dimension, one plus one dimension, or any dimension?
This is in one plus one dimension. For PEPs, it's not so trivial to make statements. This is work. This is really for matrix product states ansätze. But all our experience shows that this must hold much more general than this mathematical theorem. But it has to be tested, of course.
A comment here would be that Hastings' theorem was very well received because it formalized, well, it gave some expression. It says the one dimension only needs to grow as a power law with the system size.
Mm-hmm.
But this came in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And the MRT was, or matrix products, yeah, were invented in 1992. And there were all these, you know, already 8 years or 10 years of experience where, in practice, this is an upper bound or a lower bound.
This is an upper bound,
but
yes.
In reality, things converge so much faster than what it says here. So you know, it's nice to have a formal,
yeah,
bound, but in practice, numerical experience shows that the convergence is much, much faster than what you would read from there. For instance, for a gap system, you can even exclude the dependence on L, a finite one dimension.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is a lot of improvement, but to have such a theorem is really extremely welcome, to know that you converge. If in practice it's even better, then
right.
I don't complain. So we went on and we said, okay, so let's try this now for lattice gate series. So we went back to have the Hamiltonian system through this Legendre transformation. And then this is the Hamiltonian for the Schwinger model. You have the Pauli matrices, the gauge potential, mass term, and the electric field. You have Gauss laws. That's the change in the flux corresponds to the charge. So this is the implementation of gauge invariance in the Hamiltonian language. And then you can formulate this on the lattice. It's exactly the same as I had with the action. You have nearest neighbor interaction. You have gauge links that connect them. You have a funny-looking mass term because this is a certain discretization, comes under the name of staggered fermions, and you have the electric flux here. So these are the gauge links, and these are just the electric fields given here. So this is straightforward, and then you can do a Jordan-Wiechner transformation, and through this Jordan-Wiechner transformation, you can formulate this model now completely in terms of Pauli matrices. Here X is essentially 1 over the lattice spacing. You should remember this because we need this later. This we had already, and the sigma plus minus is the standard combination of Pauli matrices. The Gauss law in this language reads in this form that you have the flux between nearest neighbor sites is the charge. This is the charge operator. And by using this equation here, you can get rid of the flux operator in this expression here, and then you have a Hamiltonian that is purely expressed in terms of Pauli matrices, which then in turn is a perfect formulation for matrix product states, because then we can use all these techniques that were developed for condensed metaphysics. But in this formulation, it's also accessible for quantum simulations, and this was done by this group here in Innsbruck, led by Rainer Blatt and Peter Zoller, and Christine Muschig, she is now at the IQC here in Waterloo, and they have really done the very first quantum simulation of the Schwinger model. These are 6-7 qubits, but they could demonstrate an effect there. So they are going in this direction, which is a fantastic approach.
These 6 or 7 qubits are what, the fermions or the gauge degrees of freedom? Or?
These are the fermions.
The fermions.
Because you can essentially integrate out the gauge degrees of freedom and replace them by Pauli matrices. And you can gauge away the gauge links on this one-dimensional system. So this is a nice trick. The price to pay is that you get a known local interaction, but this they can handle, at least for 7 qubits. Okay. So we have the Hamiltonian. I spare you this language here. So what we then want to do is we want to get the ground state energy of the system. So what we do, we minimize this functional here with respect to the wave functions. in a graphical representation, this matrix product state, people like this. This is a state vector. This represents the operator. And then you sandwich the operator between such states. So these are just multiplication. This is the representation of a scalar product. And what you do then to have a solution, you write your wave function, this trial wave function here, in such a matrix product way. And then first you fix all matrices besides one. So you keep all these matrices fixed here. Then you concentrate on one matrix somewhere here. And then you minimize this functional here only with respect to that particular matrix. And we are talking about matrices of the size 100 by 100. Once you have done this and you found the minimum of this function, then you keep also this matrix fixed. You go to the next one, do the same procedure, and then you sweep back and forth through the whole lattice until you really converge to a certain ground state wave function that you have. Please.
How do you do the minimize, like just using like nearest neighbor, I'm sorry, gradient descent or something? Or how do you minimize the very parameter?
It's conjugate gradient. It's a generalized eigenvalue problem.
10,000 parameters in that matrix.
Huh? Say it again?
You've got like 10,000 parameters in that matrix.
I get 100 by 100 matrix, and I solve a generalized eigenvalue problem. This is not a problem anymore nowadays. Okay? So it's really doable. Okay? Stefan, sitting next to you, knows all the details about this. Don't talk now, talk later. Yeah, and then you repeat this procedure until you find convergence. I have here the algorithm, but I don't go through that now. So once you have the ground state wave function and the ground state energy, what you simply do, you have an effective Hamiltonian where you take the original Hamiltonian and you project simply out all the wave functions and energies that you have already found. And then you take this Hamiltonian to find the next wave function for the next energy. And doing this, you can go from the ground state to the next exciting state. Then you get a complete dispersion relation until you find the next excited state and so on and so on. So you can really find the spectrum of the theory, and you even find the momentum dependence and the dispersion relation. The price we have to pay is that we have to control systematics here. We have to check how large do our matrices have to be such that I find convergence really. And here what I plot is the energy computed at the maximal size of the matrix, the maximal bond dimension, and the next ones. So this is the difference between that point and that point here. And this I plot as a function of 1 over the size of the matrix. And you see, if I have matrices of a size of 100 by 100, I'm very close to the solution. And you also see that you find a very fast convergence. This is what you mentioned, which seems to be even faster than what Hastings predicted. But you have to check this, and you really have to make sure that you found this here. Sometimes there are surprises on the way. Once you have this, then you have for your system size, you have the solution of the ground state wave function. Then what you want to have the solution in the infinite volume. So you have to take all your solutions, and then you have an ansatz that is given, you can compute this, that it goes like the infinite volume energy level. Then you have a 1 over system size square correction and so on. And then you fit this, and through this fit, you get the infinite volume number for your ground state energy. And then you are still not done, because you want to have this number in the continuum limit. So you do all this procedure, infinite bond dimension, infinite system size, and then you do a continuum extrapolation. So this 1 over square root of x is essentially the lattice spacing. And this starts with the energy in the continuum limit. And then you have a linear term in the lattice spacing, and then you go on. And this is actually the most crucial part of the calculation, but we have done this, and then you have many points, and then you can compute really the energy in the continuum limit. But you have to control all these steps, which sometimes is really demanding. And then we have it. This is basically our lattice QCD calculation in the Schwinger model. We can compute the vector masses or the scalar masses at different quark masses, and you see that we get really very good accuracy below the percent level, much below the percent level, also for the scalar particle, where we actually reached the best precision of all groups. And you have a very nice check. As I told you, if you go in a Schwinger model to the massless case, you have an exact prediction for these masses, and you can check that you actually get the right number out here. So this really gives you confidence in your calculation. And to say this, I said that this X corresponds to the lattice spacing. So if I, this is 1 over the lattice spacing, meaning when X is very large, I have a very small lattice spacing. In this approach here, with matrix product states, I can go to an X value of 600, which means a very, very small lattice spacing. With Markov chain Monte Carlo, I can go to about 20. So I gain a huge factor towards the continuum limit. And the reason is, of course, that here I just have a one-dimensional system. And in Markov chain Monte Carlo, I have to take both directions into account, space and time. This is very nice. I skipped this also. And here's our goal. This is why we started all this. We wanted to see whether this Hamiltonian, this matrix product states, can solve our sign problem, can solve our problem with the complex action. And for this, we looked again at the Schwinger model with two flavors. And there is an analytical prediction by Narayanan, who said that if you go to zero temperature and you look at the change of the particle number as a function of the chemical potential, then you should find, or I find analytically, that at certain values of the chemical potential, you have first order jumps. So the phase diagram looks like this. If you go to non-zero temperature, these jumps are smoothened out and the curves look smoothened. They have a remnant of this first order phase transition, but only at zero temperature, you have this structure here. And we were wondering, can we reproduce this phase diagram? Can we really do this? And I would not be here if you couldn't do this. So this is again the Hamiltonian. The only change I have is the chemical potential here, which is flavor dependent. This is important. And this is actually the only term that we add here. This X is again 1 over the lattice spacing. Then I have again a quark mass scaled to be dimensionless and the chemical potential. And we did this calculation as usual. In order to find a change in the particle number, it was a very nice observation that the energy in the given phase is proportional to the chemical potential, the ground state energy, and the coefficient is the change in the particle number. Which means whenever you compute the ground state energy and you have a change of the slope in this energy as a function of the chemical potential, you have found the point of the first order phase transition and you can compute this delta n. So this we did as a method, and indeed what we found is exactly at the point where this analytical prediction by Narayanan predicted this, we found this first order phase transition structure. For larger chemical potential, we had some finite size effects, but here we really have this structure. So, and we did, of course, in this work as usual, we did the extrapolation to infinite bond dimension, infinite system size, and also the continuum limit. So this is the continuum limit phase diagram with a chemical potential that has a sign problem for Markov chain Monte Carlo. And we could do something else, something better. So this was in the massless case where this analytical solution exists. We can add a mass and we can do the same. There is no analytical solution available. And again, we found these first order jumps here. And what this means in the end, we can really predict the phase diagram in chemical potential and quark mass, and we can characterize these different phases. And if you let me dream for only 1 second, then if instead of this plot there, there would be this plot here, we would all be very happy. Okay. I think I simply stop here with a remark about higher dimensions. So this was all in two dimensions. So this is MPS. This is an MPS state, the product of matrices. If you go to higher dimensions, then you have the projected entanglement pair states. So these are tensors with more indices that you have to contract, and you have to put these, for example, in such a structure. You can have also different structure. This has been used already in solid state physics. The problem with this is that the cost of the computation scales with the tenth power of the bond dimension. So this means if you would have a tensor with bond dimension 10, then the computational cost would be already 10 to the 10. And you would be pretty far away from the ground state solution. So this is at the moment, this is another wall that we have. And we need new ideas for tensor networks. And there are new ideas that are being tested now. Or we need quantum simulations, because quantum simulations don't care about this bond dimension. They simply simulate the system and give you the answer. For this, we need 50 or more qubits. That's another problem. Okay, so we are working on this, and we are confident that either with matrix product state or tensor states, we can make progress, or we have progress with some quantum simulations. Okay, let me summarize. What I wanted to show you first is that in standard lattice QCD, we are really very much advanced. We have reached physical conditions. We can compute the Hadron spectrum, number of decay constants, Hadron structure, G minus 2, whatever you like and is possible. But there are really outstanding challenges, the chemical potential, the theta term, and real-time processes. And they are really at the heart of our understanding of the universe and particle interaction. There is a new ansatz, this matrix product states that we have been testing in the benchmark model of the 1+1 dimensional Schwinger model. And I showed you what we can do. We can compute the spectrum. What I didn't show you, we also can do thermal evolution of chiral gates here, of the chiral condensate. We can do chemical potential, this I showed. We have this ansatz for known Abelian gate series. And a new toy for me that we didn't do in lattice gate series, we can also look at questions of entropy in the system. These matrix product states were very successful. You can use much larger systems than is possible with Markov chain Monte Carlo, which brings you much closer to the continuum. It can solve the sign problem. We have demonstrated it. And the challenges are clearly that we want to go to higher dimensions and that we want to have experimental realizations of this. And if you didn't follow the complete talk, what we want is that we go here. So thanks a lot for your attention.
So thank you very much for this very nice overview. Are there any questions?
You mentioned that for higher dimensional tensor network methods, there are new ideas that are being tested at the moment. What exactly were you thinking of or referring to?
What I'm thinking of is to combine these matrix product states with Monte Carlo methods. So you want to try to do the contraction with Monte Carlo methods.
There's run the risk of reintroducing the sign problem, or
that's a good question. I do not know. We are just testing this. I don't think so because this is the no. I don't think so because this is really. This concerns the contractions.
You just evaluate the contraction with some kind of probabilistic algorithm, so it has to do with the physical action, right? You just mean you evaluate the contraction with some kind of probabilistic algorithm, so it's not like a physical.
Exactly, it's not a physical. Yeah.
It's variation on Monte Carlo, right? Where you have a wave function that defines your positive weights, so
yes.
You never have sign problem.
Yes.
Now you're sampling to contract these tensor networks.
Exactly. From a given probability function. And then there is the way of, there was a recent paper by Ignazio who proposes to generate Gaussian trial wave functions for the fermions. And they can be generated very fast through Monte Carlo. And this seemed to work in their example. So this might also be a very promising way to proceed. So there are ideas on the market, but this has to be tested. There's a competition going on who is first to demonstrate that we can do it. Of course, we will win. Please.
On the parallel, how parallelizable is the algorithm you proposed there?
Which one? This one?
Yes. The one you used for the Schwinger model, where you were optimizing the matrices.
How many cores do you use, Stefan?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you... think of parallelizations and yeah, everything boils down to matrix problems,
yeah.
Which are going in blast, and blast itself is parallelized. So the matrix stuff can be done in parallel. Then there's an idea from Stephen White optimized Gaudmire, how to parallelize the DMG sweeping itself, like the update. This is not yet implemented, but this still could be done. So I think there are still some potential for like these calculations are running maybe 8 or 10 cores. But the problem is you need a lot of jobs in the end, because for each ladder spacing you want a bunch of system sizes. For each combination of system size and ladder spacing you want a bunch of quantum dimensions to check your error. So you need a large number of tasks in the end to go through the entire extrapolation procedure.
So the Schwinger model was ideal because it's 1+1 dimensional.
Yeah.
And it demonstrates a number of features. Is there something similarly ideal in 2+1 dimensions?
I would go to the analog. I would go to 2+1 dimensional QED. A lot is QED. A lot is known there. You don't have complications with known abelian theories, with known abelian gauge fields. I think this would be the next step I would do. Definitely.
Not the case, let's thank the speaker again.